I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a radio conversation fed by the worldwide wisdom of the web at radioopensource.org. The Supreme Court said no yesterday by a 5-4 vote to the notion that global warming and the carbon emissions from cars that add to it are beyond the reach of the Environmental Protection Agency. Said no, that is, to the Hunter S. Thompson theory of ever more powerful cars going faster and faster, as Hunter said, until the thrill of speed overcomes the fear of death. We might as well live, as Dorothy Parker said. But can Americans break the SUV habit? And might it actually be good for the not-so-big-anymore Big Three if we learn to love fuel-efficient American cars? Post your bit on our website at www.radioopensource.org. Our man on the auto biz this hour is James P. Womack, chairman and founder of the Lean Enterprise Institute. He's the author of, among other books, The Machine That Changed the World. James Womack, how fast does a Supreme Court decision like this trickle down to a new look in American cars?
Well, this is the first skirmish in a great war. So it's not very fast in terms of just getting to concrete definition of what the court meant.
When you say first skirmish, John Dingell said, no, it's over. Let's get to the business now of regulating these cars. And he speaks for Detroit in many ways. What do you mean the first skirmish?
Well, we have to decide what an acceptable level of this pollutant is. That's what the Clean Air Act says, that you must reduce levels of pollutants to below a harmful threshold. So let's all get agreement on what that level might be. And then you have to go from there to say, well, all right, how much pollutant can these vehicles that are out there emit and keep us below that threshold? So it's even if there were no dispute here, it's an analytic challenge to figure out what that would be.
The auto companies can't have been entirely surprised by this news. What are they going to do about it?
Well, first they've got to get through the coming summer. The labor contract with the auto workers union is up in September. There is general agreement that these companies are not able to pull the legacy cost that they've got up the hill. So just to get to September is going to be quite an interesting exercise. And then once you get there, well, then we can get some resolution of that. Then we can start talking about, well, how do we adapt the car to the world that may be coming?
What does it mean when they say, as they did, that they'll help the EPA draft new emission standards?
Well, that's a generous offer that we perhaps would—
They're here to help, after all.
—not suspect would be taken up by most people with no skin in the game. Obviously, what they would propose is something that is highly incremental, that would go over a very, very long period of time. And if you think the greenhouse, what we're talking about here, is a problem at all, well, obviously there would be a disconnect between the time it would take to do anything on that schedule and what you might need to do if there really is a problem.
Is this George W. Bush EPA, which didn't want the assignment anyway, going to get busy now?
I'm very skeptical you'll see anything in this administration. Again, this is a rulemaking. They have to go out and do large amounts of testimony, hear many experts, get many witnesses, assemble data, and decide what an appropriate threshold is. And then what does that mean for the various types of emitting sources, stationary, mobile cars, factories, that would be regulated under this?
But you're not discounting the significance of this ruling, are you?
Well, I think this is one of many signs, if you will, in the wind right now, that the ethos, the gestalt is changing, that we're going from a time of expansive, everything is possible, to a time of constraint and a feeling that there really are a lot of issues out there that mean the future is actually not going to be like the past. So it's almost, even though it's spring in the Northern Hemisphere, it feels like fall, that we're going from a time of ebullience, when lots and lots of things were possible, and that's both, you know, under Clinton in the early days of, very early days of Bush, to a time that feels more like the 70s, when we were talking about limits of growth, talking about constraint, talking about the fact that humans can't just totally ignore their environment. So we had a happy interlude there, and now it feels to me like it's a much darker time.
What are the other straws that you see flying through the wind?
Well, the climate report from the scientists that were put together, the 2,500 climate scientists, probably not too many years ago, there weren't 2,500 climate scientists, which has some pretty dire possibilities on the downside. Everything's still stated to some extent in terms of probabilities rather than certainties. But that certainly has had an effect, that the Gore message, which was not taken seriously 5 years ago, is at least worth an Academy Award. And, okay, that's just what Hollywood thinks. But sort of had the feeling that maybe the justices voting in favor of this measure, this decision yesterday, had been to see the movie. If you read some of the text of that, it's full of sort of alarm about the perilous path we might be on. So you just feel that it's out there. And it, you know, it doesn't help that you have this war situation, which does not feel positive, that you have an economy that has really not generated very much for the people on the lower end of the economic scale, even here in what's been a pretty strong time. So put all that together, and it just feels like a time of sort of reflection, and perhaps we're going to be going in an opposite direction.
You know Detroit very, very well. Explain how they've resisted the logic of regulation and restraint all these years, and what will it involve for, you know, this incredible mainstay of what we think of as the traditional manufacturing economy of this country to have to catch up with Toyota?
You might think of Detroit as sort of like the retreat of the glaciers into the last ice age. They completely covered the continent 40 years ago. And then they discovered, well, we're not really competitive in very teeny little cars. You remember when the Beetle came in and they tried to counter it with the Corvair, and that didn't do so well, and the Japanese showed up with little cars. And so they said, well, these little cars are actually a loser. The public really wants big cars. Let's get them better big cars. And over time, bigger big cars. So they started to move back, start to sort of recede out of areas of the market. Well, of course, the other fellows who are all offshore, which is what creates the interesting politics, they came forward. So then Detroit said, well, we're not very good at mid-sized cars, so why don't we quit investing? We'll still offer a few, but we're going to quit investing. And then actually, we're not very good at big cars either, so why compete there? Our real advantage is with vans, with pickups, and then the invented category with the Explorer, the so-called SUV. So we'll just back up a little bit more. And, of course, the offshore competitors by that point had come onshore. They had actually made a beachhead and come right in into Ohio and Kentucky and said, oh, well, in that case, if you're going to cede that part of the market, we'll take that. And so now what you have is the kind of last stand on the opposite beach in which you've got big pickups and big SUVs as the only seriously profitable category of product, and those are now under overwhelming assault. So it's a long process, but what you see is steady retreat eventually leads to you're back to the wall and nowhere to go.
And Toyota, meantime, is about to overtake GM as the world's largest automaker.
Well, most people think that will happen this year.
What is Toyota doing right?
This is really a battle of two business systems. There's the old GM Sloan system, and there is the Toyota system. It's a different way to manage. They have just a fundamentally different way of thinking about management. It's a different way to design things. It's a different way to run factories, different way to treat suppliers. The one part of the Toyota system we've not seen is a different way to treat customers, because Toyota came in and hired all the failing GM Ford dealers as their original dealers, and in some ways got the worst of the worst, so that part of the system, the retail that you and I feel every time we take our car in, has really not changed, but everything else is now established in North America, a design system, a purchasing system, a production system, a management system that's really quite different from the old GM system and by almost any measure you can come up with, significantly better.
How many of the Toyota lessons has Detroit learned, and how many more could it learn?
I think the hardest lesson does not have to do with techniques. We can, in the factory, see all kinds of techniques. You can go look at a GM plant today, look at a Toyota plant in the United States, and from a technical standpoint, what you will see is something that's quite similar. The real difference is the management system, how managers think about their jobs, what it is they're trying to do, the measures they use. That's the real secret sauce that has proved very difficult for Americans, despite years of demonstration right in front of their eyes, has proved very difficult.
Do you want to give us the one-minute course on lean management as you sell it, evangelize it?
Well, the term lean was invented in my office at MIT in 1987, not by me, by a young grad student who said we need a name for this, and we all thought about what do we call it. We didn't want to call it Toyota-ism, didn't want to call it Japan-ism, because we knew that actually Toyota and Honda as its emulator were the two star players. So we needed a name, and we said, well, what does it do? And at that time, we had overwhelming evidence, as presented in The Machine That Changed the World, that it took less human effort to design a car that was cheaper to make, less human effort to make the car, less time, fewer defects, smaller factory, less capital investment, less. And we said, what's that? And the answer was, it's lean. So that is the essence here, that it's doing more with less.
That's one solid minute on leanness. In one more solid minute, how big a part of Detroit's overall problem is this emissions question that the Supreme Court has pointed to?
I don't see the emissions question in the short term as making much difference. That the short term
compared to pensions or health care.
Yeah, that the tremendous legacy cost is such that actually there isn't a long term unless they can deal with that. When you consider that it takes 3 to 4 years to bring out new products. And by the way, if you're going to do actually significantly new products like Prius, even Toyota took 10 years for that. So that if we say, okay, let's get serious about the greenhouse, you're not actually going to see a whole lot for quite a while. Meanwhile, these companies could easily have capsized because of sins of the past.
We're talking about the Supreme Court's order to get serious about the greenhouse and what it means for Detroit and automobiles and transportation, and us. Please join the conversation on our website at www.radioopensource. We'll be right back after a short break.
Hi, this is Brendan. I'm the open source blogger in chief, Sonny Rollins, in the studio. That's what we've got on Thursday. Anything else I could say would only be anticlimactic, but please leave him some questions in the thread. Also, we are, yes, finally building a new website. I have posted to the site an RFP, that is a request for proposal. We request that you propose to us how and for how much we build it. Make us something pretty at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about the Supreme Court's decision that the EPA can, and many will say must, regulate the auto emissions that are warming up the globe. Joseph Rome joins us from Washington, where he served in the Clinton Department of Energy. He's the founder and executive director of the Center for Energy and Climate Solutions. He's the author of Hell and High Water, Global Warming, the Solution and the Politics, and What We Should Do. He blogs at Climate Progress. Joseph Rome, welcome to Open Source.
Hello.
You heard James Womack on the auto industry. In your own view, what's the significance of this court ruling?
I think this is a bombshell. I really think this is the beginning.
A good bombshell? Or
It's a good bombshell. It's the beginning of the end of no regulations on vehicle fuel efficiency. The Detroit has been pretty much unregulated for two decades now. I don't expect the Bush EPA, the Bush administration EPA, to regulate. But Detroit knows two things. First, whoever comes into president to be president in 2009 now has this tool and doesn't have to go through Congress. So I think that's message one. But perhaps even more importantly is the fact that California and I think about eight or nine other states have passed regulations to limit greenhouse gas emissions coming out of the tailpipes of cars. And Detroit and the Bush administration had been fighting this, but I think with this new ruling, it's going to be very hard for them to win in court. And so I think that that it may well be now that California's so-called Pavley bill, which requires a 30% reduction in vehicle tailpipe emissions, will become a standard pretty soon, and other states will quickly join in. So we may not have to wait for the next president for regulations to come out of this new Supreme Court decision.
If they said, you know, better to switch than fight, how soon could we see a new automobile coming out of Detroit, and what would it look like?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to realize is that, you know, the technology to run cars, the engines and so on, have gotten considerably more efficient in the past two decades. But instead of using that for fuel economy, it's been used to make vehicles heavier and give them more acceleration. So, you know, we have, you know, massive horsepower in large vehicles now. It wouldn't be that hard for Detroit to simply make fewer of the super heavy vehicles and perhaps not have them accelerate as much. So I don't think it would ever be difficult for Detroit to go, you know, let's say a 30% improvement. The leapfrog technologies, if you want a double efficiency, that's obviously going to take, as Dr. Womack said, it took Toyota a long time to introduce the Prius hybrid technology. I would be inclined to think that, if you wanted to have a significant increase in fuel economy, that might, you know, have to be phased in over 10 years.
But even the hybrids, I mean, the Prius is a pretty heavy, high-performing automobile. When do we have a sort of a culture shift? Or what would it take toward a mini vehicle?
Well, that is a good question. Mini vehicles do quite well in Europe, but of course there are considerably higher prices for gasoline there. I think that, you know, there hasn't been a very successful small, tiny car sold in the U.S. I think some foreign manufacturers are pursuing that. But, you know, I think we're going to have to see gasoline prices spike up again, which I would not be surprised if they do. But, I do want to say that I don't think we have to force people into tiny cars in order to dramatically reduce greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, I think that what Toyota has shown with the Prius and Honda with the Civic and even Ford with the Escape is that you can build a fuel-efficient car using hybrid technology, and because you've got the extra electric motor on board, you don't have to sacrifice performance at all. You do have to pay for this, but, you know, people pay for, you know, sunroofs, and they pay for leather seating, leather interior, and, you know, I think that as hybrids become more commonplace, you know, Toyota has said they intend to bring down the extra cost of a hybrid in half. So I would expect in the next decade to see hybrids become fairly normal. Certainly, Toyota has said they're going to make introduce hybrid versions of all their major models. And I think Ford, you know, I hope Ford is going to follow suit. But we've waited for the auto companies to see the light on fuel efficiency for two decades, and they haven't done it. And I think it is one of the reasons why they're in the position they're in. It's certainly not the only reason, and it may not even be the biggest reason. But certainly their inability or unwillingness to build a consumer-friendly, fuel-efficient vehicle is one reason why Toyota and Honda have been eating away at their market share.
Joseph Rome and James Womack, too, are you advocating higher prices at the gas pump to get us where we got to go?
Well, look, my view is that
James Womack,
we're going to be serious about this when you start talking about taxes, that everything else is a little bit of a shell game, that you've seen what's happened with these, the corporate average fuel economy regulations, that the industry immediately goes to work as soon as you promulgate them to think of workarounds. And it's just very hard. And also,
I don't notice all of these things. Just what do you mean?
Well, what they have, the first thing they did was separate cars from trucks. And then the next thing they did was say, well, let's call an awful lot of vehicles that might look to you and me like cars, let's call them trucks. because trucks, we all know, are used for commercial purposes and therefore are going to burn more fuel and so therefore should have more lenient standards. So it's the Washington game, that once you put the regulations in, all the lobbyists go to work. And so it's very easy to, over time, watch things dissipate. The nice thing about taxes is they're very visible and everybody gets it. The terrible thing about taxes from a politician's standpoint is that you can figure out who imposed them. So that's always kind of the last resort, just do the simple thing. And say, for example, that we are going to fix the real price of gasoline or carbon fuels so that it goes steadily up in real terms, very predictably, which, by the way, that part the car industry would love. Predictability is one of the most important things when you're building a durable good with a very long investment cycle. So if you said, gosh, we're going to raise the price of fuel in real terms X percent a year until we get greenhouse emissions under control, then I'll believe we're serious. Until then, I'm not so sure.
Joseph Rome, this is your chance to endorse gasoline taxes if you want to take it.
Well, I think, strictly as a policy measure, it's a good idea. Politically, Dr. Womack said, it is proven to be a very, very hard sell. I worked for the Clinton administration, and frankly, there was a big hue and cry over 4 cents a gallon. Mm-hmm. I think that it might be good to put a floor on prices. The floor, people have talked about putting a floor on oil prices so that they can't go too low in order to give alternatives, a certainty that that the Saudis wouldn't drop the price of oil and therefore render the alternatives unprofitable. Hmm. I think we need a carbon price, absolutely, a price for carbon dioxide emissions. That would, I agree it should be, clear what the price is and what, that it's going to rise a few percent each year. And that kind of certainty allows everybody the ability to make smart decisions. I mean, right now, the price of gasoline goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down, and that just convinces consumers, that they don't have to necessarily change their behavior or their purchasing patterns. So, but I am a fan of fuel economy regulations. There's no question that the auto companies did a workaround. We did, however, double the fuel economy of cars. The kind of the loophole that allowed a different fuel economy standard for SUVs certainly proved very popular. But we can make fuel efficient SUVs now, and I think even the heaviest models of SUVs aren't doing that well. So we're already seeing some downsizing in SUVs, and if we could get more efficient technology, including hybrid technology, on SUVs, they could have considerably higher mileage. So I would like to see higher fuel economy standards for cars and light trucks. I'd like to see a flexible system that encouraged innovation and discouraged cheating. I'm not saying that, government is always smart enough to figure out how to do that, but I do think that the regulations have worked in the past and can be designed better in the future.
Joseph Rome, you heard James Womack say that there are a lot of straws in the wind pointing to a sort of culture shift from ebullience to limits and restraints and constraints. Do you see them?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wrote Hell and High Water. It was based on lots of scientific studies. I think in the last 2 or 3 years, the scientific evidence for global warming has become ironclad, and that's why in February the 2,500 scientists, as Dr. Womack said that there was a greater than 90% chance that the warming we've seen is primarily due to human causes. And, I think Vice President Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth, has helped stimulate things. And I think it is now eminently clear, most regular people I talk to know that the climate has been weird. I mean, in Washington, D.C., we had cherry blossoms blooming in January, and I never find that it's that hard to explain to anybody, who's over, let's say, 40 and who saw what the climate was like 2 decades ago. They know the climate is changing. The big question is, what's the cause? And scientists have said that it's greenhouse gas emissions. So I do think that we are seeing, and the Supreme Court decision, one more nail in the coffin of the doubters. And by the way, what I think this means is that the world is in the process of moving towards very serious greenhouse gas regulations. I don't think the Bush administration is prepared, but the next president, the leaders in both the leading Democrat and Republican candidates are all in favor of greenhouse gas regulations. We're already seeing Europe and Japan take action. So the point is that the car of the future is going to be a low greenhouse gas car, and hopefully Detroit will be smart enough to figure that out. If not, they may, you know, if the government has to require them to build the cars, I think that's better than nothing, although I think it would be a good idea if Detroit figured out for themselves that in 20 years, people are going to expect a very fuel-efficient, low greenhouse gas car, and the time to start really introducing models and get learning about them is now.
James Womack, I'd be interested in your view too, Joseph. What is the Katrina contribution to this change of thinking?
Well, it's another sort of indicator of just how vulnerable we might be. That, again, we go, it seems to me, in this country through cycles of thinking we're relatively invincible and invulnerable, and we're now in a down cycle. It turns out there are a lot of things we can't control. That begins to be pretty frightening. And things that you hadn't thought about or hadn't noticed, suddenly you do think about and suddenly loom large. So was Katrina the reason we're going to have a greenhouse movement of some sort? Well, obviously not by itself. That's some small piece. But I think it is part of, again, the feeling in the air that things are more fragile, perhaps, than we would like to think and we until recently thought. And now it's time for some reflection on whether perhaps we're on the wrong course.
Joseph Rome, I wonder, does anybody see a means by which this whole crisis could be part of a rescue of Detroit or not? Is there any way back for the big three?
Well, there have been proposals put on the table, one of which was called healthcare, kind of dubbed healthcare for hybrids, in which the government would sweeten the pot. In order to get higher fuel economy standards, the government might be willing to take over some of the health care obligations or help with them. So, you know, I hope that there could be a grand bargain. I'm certainly not opposed to it. I think, you know, I don't want to I don't disagree with you know, Dr. Womack certainly understands the auto industry as well as anyone in the country. It has problems. It has claimed that if it were forced to build fuel efficient vehicles, that would hurt it. I argue that if we had fuel economy regulations, if they had been forced to build fuel efficient cars earlier, they might not be in such bad shape right now. Because there are, as I said, technologies available today that make vehicles more efficient. And if everyone has to make them more efficient, then it's okay if the vehicles cost a little more. So I see this as in the beginning, a technology-based solution. And that can be very, that could be very good. I don't see why Detroit can't match the Japanese in technology. I think that it's, you know, I will say that when I was at the Department of Energy, we had a program called the Partnership for a New Generation of Vehicle to develop a triple-efficiency hybrid vehicle with all the automakers. So this is something that they have been on, you know, working on for a long time. They kind of walked away from that technology when President Bush took office. But, anyone who says that Detroit can't match the rest of the world in innovative technology, I think, you know, I don't agree with that.
James Womack, what is Detroit afraid of?
Well, look, Detroit was superlatively effective at building, if I may say, vehicles Americans liked. That we had the lowest energy pricing in the world. We had the least congested cities. We had the most wide open spaces. And it's a big part of America. You get in your car when you don't like what's going on and you go somewhere else. So I think it's a little bit unfair to say that the folks in Detroit were misleading us, that kind of tricked us into going out and buying all those pickups and big SUVs. I think that's exactly what Americans wanted. Now things are changing, and you have this transitional problem that, guess what, American companies have really been very good at building great big vehicles, and they're not very good at building smaller vehicles. Now suddenly you tell them, hey, go build smaller vehicles for which you have no reputation. Most people's view of smaller American product is not very good. So, wow, this is a big transition to go from what you're really good at, and which, by the way, people wanted, to something you're not very good at, and people are now discovering they may have to have.
So are you talking about cars we wanted or that we you think we still want?
Oh, who knows? I don't have the survey data on that. I've never been one driving around in one of these great big things, so I'm probably the wrong guy to ask.
Well, I would make one point. I'd be interested in Dr. Womack's thought on this, but it is certainly true that Detroit played up the notion that SUVs were safer, and even though they knew that they really weren't safer. And so they left the public with the impression in their ads that these would be safer vehicles, and that's one of the reasons they proved so popular. So, I mean, I would agree. I mean, I'm not saying Americans are buying cars they don't want, but demand gets created, and anyone with any degree of forethought would have seen higher oil prices coming, you know, and because all the oil, you know, most of the world's oil reserves are in unstable regions or led by governments that don't like us. So, you know, I think that this the fact that Detroit was caught unprepared for higher oil prices, you know, they can only blame themselves.
Quick follow, Dr. Womack.
Well, look, in 1979, we would have said it's completely obvious higher oil prices are coming, and guess what? Oil prices fell steadily for the next 25 years. So you're a business planner. You're trying to get through the quarter and through the year. You've got stockholders. When you're going to go, where you're going to place your bets, hey, it's harder than it sounds.
We're talking about the next American car to save the climate on Open Source. We'll be right back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about fuel-efficient cars that might save the planet from overheating. Tom Magliozzi, one of the Car Talk brothers on NPR, lives right across the street from our office, so we invited him over this afternoon to chat about cars. We asked him what Detroit is thinking about global warming.
Detroit doesn't care about global warming, it appears. What Detroit cares about is making more and more money. And the SUV was such a magnificent road because they could spend an extra $1,000 and make another $15,000 or $20,000.
Have you doped out the appeal of the SUV?
Oh, sure. I think it's obvious. Whatever you think it is what it is. It's big. It makes people feel stronger. It makes them feel more powerful. It makes them see things better because they're up higher. I mean, I was in Italy recently, and they're driving smart cars. The smart car can park in a space that is as long as the current cars are wide. So you could take a car that would have taken up a car's length, and you could take and park four smart cars there by putting them straight into the curb. The Italians have learned how to do that. Of course, they've been learning that for a long, long time because they had the old Cinquecento, as you may remember, which is coming back, I understand. Hmm. And we can learn it too. I mean, we love the monstrous cars, but we have always been outrageous about the monstrous cars. The 60s and 70s were unbelievable for big cars. And did we care about the gasoline? No. There's something about size that makes Americans feel good.
You surely recognize the voice, but that was Tom Magliozzi of Car Talk with us in our office earlier today. We're never sure whether he is click or clack. They never say, but that was Tom. Kevin Wilson joins us from Michigan. He's the senior editor of Auto Week. Kevin, you're in Detroit. What is the reaction to all this news, and what would the reaction be to Tom Magliozzi?
Well, a lot of us might agree with Tom about what happened with the SUV, about why it had an appeal and why it happened. Certainly that the profit margins were big. The part that people don't always equate with that is that, generally speaking, Americans have not been willing to pay the kind of prices it takes to make a small car. You know, if they get a small car, they assume it's going to be cheap. So then they go out and they buy a cheap car and they say, gee, this is cheap.
But, you know, Tom Magliozzi, whose background is in marketing, doesn't let Detroit off the hook. He says they made us want cars that are much bigger than they need to be and maybe bigger than, you know, our real dreams.
Well, I would agree with that. I don't quite give the marketers the complete credit for that kind of power to persuade us. But if they did, they had complicit accomplices in the insurance industry and the government, which kept putting out stories that, you know, the heavier the vehicle, the safer you're going to be in a crash.
Hmm. James Womack has been saying that, you know, this is one straw in a wind that's full of them. Does Detroit feel a wind of a real change out there?
Oh, yeah. I think it's mischaracterizing Detroit to say that they don't care about this stuff. You know, last year we were treated with, you know, headlines every time we turned around that General Motors was losing billions of dollars and, you know, they were about to go under. And in that, you know, the same period of time when they were losing all this money, they put more than $1 billion into developing not only fuel cells, but electrification of the car. They're working on a series hybrid, the thing that was shown at the Detroit auto show called the Volt. It'll be showing up against at the Shanghai show. They've got Saturn hybrids coming to market in the year. So it's not as though they're completely ignoring it. But they have been caught with this sort of shift away from their most profitable vehicles, and they've got, the problems that Dr. Womack references in terms of, you know, longstanding costs for health care and retirement funds and that sort of thing.
Kevin Wilson and company, stand by for a question from our blogger-in-chief, Brendan Greeley.
We spent some time poking around the blogosphere this afternoon. We found a post by the blogger Joel Machauer. He just returned from the North American International Auto Show in Detroit. It is the world's largest auto show. He writes, "It's a car lover's dream. The latest and shiniest new models and concept cars. The scene augmented by testosterone-pounding music. Attractive women stand vapidly around sporty and luxury models just in case the vehicles themselves aren't titillating enough. But where was the green? This year, environmentally minded vehicles and innovation seemed few and far between. The well-choreographed and elaborately staged press events focused far more on horsepower. Muscle was probably the show's most exercised buzzword." So is the auto show a different market than the consumer market we've been talking about? Or is it possible that in a year or two years, the buzzword at the show could be green?
Well, Kevin Wilson.
I believe that's been the buzzword of the show fairly often recently. It depends on where you look. I mean, if you wandered over to the Toyota stand at the Detroit Auto Show, you saw 14 large pickup trucks set to compete against the GM and Ford models that have been the top-selling vehicles in this country for decades. Like I said, there was that Volt over at General Motors. There were quite a few green things if you look for them. They didn't have sexy women standing beside them, I'll grant that.
Green women. Kevin Wilson, I mean, your readership is made up of hardcore American car buffs. Are they getting religion?
Some of them are, some of them aren't. I've written about global warming a couple times in my column, and I sort of take a moderate position, and therefore I catch it from both sides. There are people who think that global warming is the greatest issue facing us today who say, well, I'm not entitled to talk about it because my magazine writes about 600 horsepower Ferraris or something.
Why would your readers react to cover shots on Auto Week of cars that get 80 miles per gallon?
They haven't reacted well when it's happened.
The first story
I had that hit the cover was back in 1991. I was writing about a hydrogen fuel cell car that Mercedes-Benz had built, and it was a huge van, you know. They put up with it a couple times a year, but if we did it regularly, No, those are commuter cars. They're not necessarily fun to drive. But we do have a large segment that believes that efficiency is a good thing. You know, minis and small sports cars have always touted efficiency.
James Womack, are you ready for a culture change?
Well, I think there's a difference between what you want and what you realistically think you can have. We've seen big drops in sales of big SUVs, big pickups. Does that mean people don't like them anymore? I don't know if there's any evidence of that. People simply have looked at their wallet, looked at the gas pump, and said, gee whiz, this thing is richer than what I can afford. So you can have big changes in consumption without any change in attitudes, and it's just hard to know whether what we're seeing now is a fundamental attitudinal shift or whether we're just seeing some realism on the part of the guy who says, gosh, I can't pay $3 a gallon for this big vehicle.
Kevin Wilson, I wonder what you think the consumers are ready for, which is not to say your subscribers necessarily, but the people who actually buy cars.
Consumers, by and large, consumers always want everything you can give them. You know, if you can give me 40 miles per gallon and I can still have seven seats so that when I go to the soccer game I can only take one car, they'll take that. Sure they will. They always sign up for that. Delivering that to them at a price they want is another question. I think that the automakers, I think someone said earlier, Dr. Womack said, that the automakers would really welcome an increase in gas prices because it would actually help them sell some of the smaller product and the more fuel-efficient product that they can and do build everywhere in the world. You know, people say Detroit, and they forget that these are global enterprises, and General Motors builds and sells small fuel-efficient cars in Europe and Asia, South America.
Do they make a profit on them?
Yes, they do. For one thing, you can charge more for a small, high-quality car in Europe because people don't expect it to be ultra-cheap just because it's smaller than, you know, a Chevy Impala or something. So they make profit over there, and they make smaller cars. The smart car is coming to America, by the way, within a year or year and a half, I think.
In what form?
It will be a new smart car that's being developed for America, but it'll be on that small platform. The smart brand car that Tom was talking about that he'd seen in Italy, very small car.
What does it cost? Is it something like the Mini? I mean, the
it's
the
smaller
Morris Mini.
It makes a Mini look big.
Really?
Yeah.
What does it cost?
Say $15,000, but that's not authoritative.
Mm-hmm. What's the prospect, Dr. Womack?
Well, it's a two-seat city car.
Yeah.
If we had more cities, which is to say dense European-style cities, I think it would be a more likely answer. The fact is we don't. We've spent a century since the car became a mass product with the Model T, which is 100 years ago next year. We've spent a century building the world's most spread-out cities where everything is far apart, and I think there's a real question of how far you want to go in your two-seater that is actually quite a modest conveyance. And it's one thing to say I don't need the great big pickup, but it's something else to say I think I'll take this little mini-mini, and I'm going to feel comfortable in that very quickly.
What is the chance that if automakers gave Americans much more efficient cars, we'd simply drive more and cancel the reduction in the carbon footprint?
Well, that effect has been measured. It's called the rebound effect. I think it's getting to be relatively modest just because people are driving so much now that the vehicle miles traveled has started to slow. There's only so much you can drive any given year. I did want to make one point, which I do think is that new technology is sort of bringing back electrified cars, the lithium-ion battery, and I think the GM Volt. I think we're going to see plug-in hybrids, hybrids that can be plugged into the electric grid and run on gasoline or electricity. I think that car is just around the corner, 2-3 years away, I expect. Toyota and GM will introduce them. And I think when people see their the benefits. These are cars that in fact will, for much of driving, will get 80, 100 miles a gallon. I think they'll be quite attractive to a lot of people.
James Womack, you're skeptical.
Well, I take a little bit different view that the reason this is going to be popular in industry is that it gives the electric utility something to do at night. you charge up cars at night and you've got extra capacity. Where'd you get the fuel? Is that carbon-free fuel? Maybe you're going to run it off nukes. Maybe you're going to run it off hydro. But a lot of what you're going to see now in industry is a big battle of burden shifting, in which the electric power guys say, well, the car guys are really not doing their job. And the car guys say, whoa, do you know how much greenhouse gas is coming out of the tailpipe of that jet airplane per passenger traveled, per passenger mile? It's those the guys that ought to be doing it. So there's a real opportunity here, particularly in the lobbying world, to play the burden-shifting game, and we'll see how it all turns out.
Kevin Wilson, I'm wondering, what, in your view, is the fix that we actually need to save the habitat?
I think that the car companies, although they were not happy about today's decision at the Supreme Court about the EPA, I think Dr. Womack's right in terms of the burden shifting and not just focusing on cars. Cars and trucks cost about 25% of America's CO2 emissions. A lot of it is stationary sources and other transportation, the beef industry, all kinds of things like that. And if the EPA is really going to regulate a greenhouse pollution across America, I think it may take some of the focus off the car people. Not entirely, but I think that you're not going to find the solution just in the car when the car is only 25% of the problem. I think also when we talk about SUVs, we talk about it in this sort of a philosophical tone, and we think, these people are buying these SUVs and they're just putting one person in them and commuting to work. Well, that's what happens Monday to Friday. But there's a lot of American society that has an SUV, and they can't afford to have both an SUV and a commuter car, so they get the SUV, and at the weekends they're towing boats, they're towing trailers. There's a lot of lifestyle stuff that ties into our economy where you can't just sort of have this radical shift and say, we're all going to stop vacationing at our second home 300 miles away and taking our boat with us or our skidoos or whatever it is.
I should know the answer to this, and I don't. What connection do the business pages make with this news from the Supreme Court, among other things, and a jump almost 130 points on the Dow Jones average today? I mean, what happened to the car stocks today?
I don't know what happened to the car stocks today. I'm sorry.
Then you may give us your piece of advice, Kevin Wilson, on a gasoline tax.
I love the gasoline tax thing. I've suggested gasoline.
You like
tax
the thing, or you like
times.
The tax?
Well, I like the tax because it what it does is it changes behavior immediately. If you tomorrow got Congress to get real brave and say we're going to have 40 mile per gallon cars, that would take some years to roll out. And even if the automakers all flipped over and said, okay, in September we're going to start selling 40 mile per gallon cars, we only turn about 8% of the fleet in a typical year. It takes you 12 to 15 years to get 40 miles per gallon out there on the road. If you increase the price of gas with taxes, people start changing their behavior. They change what they buy. They change how they use the car. The half-mile trip to get a gallon of milk either doesn't happen or you walk or you fold it into another trip that you're going to be making. People start getting efficient about their use of the resource. Another thing I think that hasn't been mentioned in this show is that we do still have something called a gas guzzler tax in America, and it could use some beefing up if you really wanted to drive the demand side of the equation and get the market saying we want more fuel-efficient product. You can tax at the sale point the vehicle. Right now, the gas guzzler tax ranges from, I think, a low of $1,000 if your car gets less than 22.5 miles per gallon, and goes up to $7,700. But there's been a lot of lobbying along the way in the way they define which cars have to pay it. And mostly it's a lot of high performance and big luxury cars. If you were really serious about making everybody move to cars that got 25 or 30 miles per gallon, you could certainly tax those at sale. Now, the way that works...
We're for everybody taking out subscriptions to Auto Week, too. Kevin Wilson, thank you. Joseph Rome, James Womack, interesting hour. You can keep talking about automobiles. You can help us work on the next shows. And you can pitch us a show idea of your own at radioopensource.org. Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Landmine Survivors Network, offering health, opportunities, and rights to mine victims worldwide. Landminesurvivors.org. Radioopensource.org, the website, is hosted by Contegix, Contegix.com. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Murs, Robin Amer, and Greta Pemberton, with help from Julia Reichel and Sam Gail Rosen. Ray Fallon was our engineer. Mary McGrath is our auto industry. I'm Christopher Light, and join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.